When Eugene Peterson started publishing parts of his translation of the Bible called The Message, he never thought it would become a phenomenon, but it did. To date, it sold 15 million copies worldwide, and it made Eugene Peterson a star in the world of Christian publishing. You'd hardly know it from speaking with him. Eugene Peterson is a soft-spoken poet. He's a professor, a scholar, but most importantly, a pastor. And that last role is the one that's defined his life more than any other. It's also the title of his new memoir, About Life in a Congregation. And Pastor Peterson joins me now from his home in Montana. Welcome.
Thank you.
Your book is titled The Pastor, but there's a subtitle on the front cover, the words Every Step and Arrival. They're printed right at the bottom. What are those four words about?
They're words from a poem by Denise Levertov, in which she's talking about her vocation development as a poet. And she has a wonderful line in there about her dog going intently haphazard from fire hydrant to bush to tree. He knows where he's going, but he couldn't articulate to you, but he knows he's got a nose for what he wants to do. And when I read those lines, I thought, that's what I've been doing all my life.
Hmm.
I never knew where I was headed. And then at some point, I realized it was pastor.
You actually described your introduction to congregations as a young child, a young apprentice to your father working in his butcher shop in Montana. Not the most obvious place that springs to mind when I think of a congregation, but to you, it was a holy place. You actually write that the butcher shop was a holy place.
Yes, when I was a little kid, my mother would make me an apron, just like my dad's apron, white apron. And I knew the story of Samuel, who was taken to the temple and given a robe. His mother would make him a robe every year to accommodate his growth. And I always thought of myself as Samuel, wearing a priestly robe. And my dad was a priestly kind of person. Everybody who came in that place was greeted by their first name. It was holy work for him.
You describe your father as a very humble man. Prostitutes would come into his butcher shop, and he would not judge them. He would treat them just like he did everybody else, with respect.
That's right.
That must have made a real impression on you as a kid.
Oh, it did. Because the brothel was just about two streets down from our shop, and there was always talk on the street about the whores. But when they came into our store, people knew their first names. They treated them with dignity. They were in a safe place. Later on, that translated for me into a congregation. When you come into the sanctuary, it's a safe place.
Most people know you, and many people came to know you because of your book, The Message. Obviously, there are many translations of the Bible. There's the New International Version and the King James Bible and many others. What made you decide to write your own?
Well, I really didn't decide to do that. I had done things for my own congregation.
Hmm.
I translated Galatians for them. And I was very at home in the biblical languages. I taught them for 3 years in a seminary. So it was more of a playful thing for me. I was trying to get this scriptural language into the idiom, the vernacular of the people that I was working with. And I would never have dreamed of translating the Bible.
Almost every committed Christian I know, including many young Christians, has a copy of The Message. It became this enormous event in Christian publishing. Were you surprised by that?
I was totally surprised.
Mm. What did you expect?
I expected they'd pay me what they told me they'd pay me, and it would drop out of the world. It really did surprise me.
My guest is Pastor Eugene Peterson, best known for his best-selling book, The Message, The Bible in Contemporary Language. He has a new memoir out. It's called The Pastor. Pastor Peterson, I believe you're 78 years old right now. Is that right?
That's right.
So I imagine you've read the Bible more than a few times over the course of your life. Do you find that your own view of the Bible has changed as you've gotten older?
Not really. I had a home in a small town and a church where nobody was very important. But they read the Bible. They knew how to read the Bible, to listen for God. And so I think I was trained quite early in this way of not studying, but receiving, letting the words shape you instead of you using the words to do something you want to do.
As a young man, you were in your early 30s when you became the pastor of the Presbyterian Church, Christ the King, near Baltimore, and you stayed there for almost 30 years. Was there ever a time where your confidence, your faith was shaken a little bit?
Yeah, those early years after what I call the Badlands, when my competitive instincts weren't working anymore. Yeah, there were 6 years when I just didn't know what I was. Nothing was seemed to be working.
That's a long time.
It is a long time.
How did you get over it? Did it just pass, or did you have to really work at it?
Well, see, that was the problem. I was used to working at things, and now working at things didn't make any difference. So I found some people to talk to. I started running. I was always a runner in school and started running. I didn't know adults ran. And so that became a way to be competitive without being competitive. So it was many of these things. We started keeping Sabbaths, my wife and I. The most important person in teaching us how to do this was Abraham Heschel, the Jewish rabbi. So we just kind of lived into that Sabbath world of rest, and we were almost like Orthodox Jews in what we did. We took it seriously. So there were a number of things like that. It wasn't a program. It was, well, maybe it goes each step an arrival. Each thing we did led to something else. But after about 6 years, I can't tell you just what happened, but all of a sudden it just seemed like here I was. I was whole. All that stuff had gotten integrated into something which was more like a joyful, obedient life rather than a striving, mastering life.
What did you love about being a pastor the most?
This might seem like an odd answer to it, but I think it's the intimacy. You're in a place of pain and joy and boredom, and everything is more or less intensified in the pastoral vocation, the whole range of what it means to be a human being. When I went from being a pastor to being a professor, that's what I missed most. I missed the ordinariness of the congregation, but that entering into these lives of just incredibly rich intimacy sometimes took years to accomplish that or to enter into that, both for them and for me. But I think the intimacy, yes.
Pastor Peterson, what an incredible journey you've had.
It has been. Yes, it has been.
And you're back where you were born. You're back in Montana.
Yes.
Sort of completes a circle in a way, doesn't it?
It really does. We live in a house that my dad built. This is the country I grew up in. These are the hills that I played cowboy and Indian in and joined Lewis and Clark in their exploration of this country. So, yeah, it's very storied.
That's Pastor Eugene Peterson. He's Professor Emeritus of Spiritual Theology at Regent College in Vancouver, British Columbia. His memoir, The Pastor, is in bookstores now. Pastor Peterson, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The Space Shuttle Discovery is set to land Wednesday at Kennedy Space Center in Florida, and then it's off to a Smithsonian retirement. The NASA shuttle program is ending. Now, museums all around the country are eager to get one of the two other surviving orbiters, Endeavour and Atlantis. NPR's Noah Adams reports on the hopes and dreams of one Midwest museum.
If you want to make NASA officials happy when you're trying to sell your museum, tell them about the yellow school buses out in the parking lot. The kids come in here, their heads full of computer games, and they see actual airplanes and actual rockets.
And we get that question a lot from students. Is this real? And you go, yes, it really is. This airplane actually flew during World War II.
Judith Wen runs the educational programs here at the Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio. She loves to hear the word wow.
You can see, for instance, a shuttle on television, but imagine standing right next to it. The shuttle orbiter itself is 122 feet long. The distance of the Wright brothers' first flight was 120 feet.
I'm inside the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force. It's part of the Air Force. It's on the Wright-Patterson base. The Wright brothers' original flying field is nearby. There is a teachable heritage here, and Dayton also fits with NASA's thoughts about location. Put the shuttles where the people are. Lieutenant General U.S. Air Force retired Jack Hudson is the museum director.
We have free admission and free parking here, and we're within a day's drive of 61% of the American population.
That indeed is the mantra of the Air Force Museum. Close to a lot of people, it's free. And as my wife's Uncle Bob always tells me, NOAA, it's got the best air conditioning in Ohio. To go through the museum, that's a long day's walking. More than 300 exhibits. The B-29 that dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki. The SR-71 Blackbird reconnaissance plane. Titan missiles and Apollo space capsule. And for General Jack Hudson and his team of curators, it's important to get the planes that come with stories.
The A-10 that you see over here was flown by a pilot whose name is Paul Johnson. He flew that in Operation Desert Storm on an 8-hour mission where he was flying top cover for other people who were rescuing a downed pilot. So people have worked long and hard to get the right kind of airplanes in here with the right significance. The one that we really would like to have to be the capstone of the collection is a shuttle.
Space shuttle now rolling over onto its back with 8.5-minute ride into orbit. Discovery now making one last reach for the stars.
Discovery is at this moment in orbit. The shuttles Endeavour and Atlantis each have one more flight.
My name is Mark Brown. I'm a former Air Force colonel, fighter pilot, and engineer, and I'm also a former astronaut.
Mark Brown has flown on Discovery and Challenger. He's on the board of the Air Force Museums Foundation. They're raising money for a new space gallery. The shuttle would arrive here outside, flying on top of a 747, and then new visitors.
Right now we have a little over 1.1 million people a year come through, and if you're really optimistic, we could actually double that.
Mark Brown wants to collect memories from all the former astronauts to help the museum bring space closer.
When you're actually going out to the launch pad, you're all wearing your orange pressure suits, and you're riding in the Astrovan, which is a shiny, you know, aluminum RV for all intents and purposes, down the road out to the rocket that's on the launch pad. And you feel like you're in a science fiction movie. It is really cool. And you're looking around at each other like, wow, we're going to go to space today. How often are you going to do that?
In April, NASA will announce where the other two shuttles are going. The Kennedy Space Center in Florida is said to be a favorite site, along with the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Museums on the West Coast have a chance, and the Dayton Air Force Museum. Noah Adams, NPR News, Dayton, Ohio.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. On Thursday, members of the House Committee on Homeland Security will assemble for a hearing on, quote, the extent of radicalization in the American Muslim community and that community's response. The hearings have been called by Congressman Peter King, a Republican from New York who chairs the House Homeland Security Committee. King says al-Qaeda affiliates are radicalizing some American Muslims.
We're talking about al-Qaeda. We're talking about the affiliates of al-Qaeda who have been radicalizing, and there's been self-radicalization going on within the Muslim community, within a very small minority, but it's there, and that's where the threat is coming from at this time. To be having investigations into every type of violence will be suggesting an equivalency that's not there.
We've invited Congressman King to be a guest on the program, and we do hope he will join us at some point to talk about the hearings and what he hopes to accomplish. But in the meantime, the focus on Muslim Americans has sparked anger and anxiety from other quarters, especially groups that represent Muslim Americans, such as the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Amnesty International, and the Interfaith Alliance. We plan to host a series of conversations previewing the upcoming hearings, including a conversation with a Muslim American who supports the premise of the hearing and plans to testify. But first, we wanted to get some perspective and reaction from a lawmaker who knows something about the challenges of confronting the concerns of a nation and also something about the growing concern of Muslim Americans. Congressman Andre Carson is a Democrat representing Indiana's 7th District. He is one of two Muslim Americans serving in the U.S. Congress, and he's with us now in our Washington, D.C. studio. Representative Carson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm so honored to be here. Thank you.
I did want to ask you, when you first heard that these hearings would be called, what your reaction was.
Well, I was very suspicious of the premise behind the hearings, and I wonder if this really helps. I don't think it helps. I think it discourages Muslim Americans from participating with law enforcement and acting effectively as informants in many cases, and really bridging the gap between law enforcement and our Muslim communities across this country.
Well, Congressman King, I think, points to, as we mentioned, we would like an opportunity to speak with him directly, but certainly he will discuss this at the hearing. There have been incidents involving people who just happen to be American citizens who have engaged in or attempted to engage in acts of terrorism. I mean, one of the most high-profile examples was a man who last May parked a car bomb in New York's Times Square. The bomb failed to detonate. But people look at incidents like that, and they believe that there is something to at least talk about and think about, that it is a relevant issue in considering the entire picture of national security. What do you say to that, people who have those concerns?
You know, 7 out of the last 10 al-Qaeda plots threatening the U.S. since 9/11 have been prevented with the help of Muslims. And this is a fact that comes from the Muslim Public Affairs Council. But now, overall, almost 40% of al-Qaeda terror plots threatening the U.S. since 9/11, Michelle, were foiled with the assistance of Muslims. In a report compiled in 2008 by the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, START, Islamic extremists weren't even in the top 10 for the groups that state police organizations and agencies across our country reported. We had neo-Nazis in the top 10, militia patriot groups, skinheads, freemen, environmentalist groups, the KKK, extreme anti-tax groups, anti-immigration groups, and others, and Islamic jihadi groups came in at a distant 11 on the list. That's not to say we don't have serious national security concerns as it relates to so-called Muslims plotting attacks. I worked in Homeland Security. I'm the only member of Congress to date who has worked at Homeland Security in an intelligence fusion center dealing with counterterrorism and intelligence. But having said that, it is critical. We will not win the war against terrorism without help from Muslims.
What is a more constructive way, in your view, to have this conversation?
Well, I think it's important that the Department of Homeland Security and local law enforcement agencies take a concerted effort to reach out to mosques across this country and say, hey, we are not here to hurt you. We're not going to show up in your mosque, one, without probable cause. We're not going to have national security letters as a means of investigating you. And Muslims have to feel safe in their communities. Muslims have to know that law enforcement is there to protect. Now, of course, there are serious issues with racial profiling that I know as an African-American male. There are issues with religious profiling. But if law enforcement in our communities of interest take the step to engage with Muslim communities, I think you'll find not only assistance, but you'll find greater insights. You'll have multilingual interpreters when you need be, and you'll have a groundswell of support in terms of receiving tips for any suspicious activities that may occur in these Islamic centers.
But when you look, for example, at another case that has obviously was a very traumatic experience for the country and for the people involved, Major Nidal Hassan, an American citizen wearing the uniform of the United States, but at some point embraced a hostile view of his fellow citizens and acted upon it and killed people and shot and wounded many people at Fort Hood. How should an issue like that be discussed?
Well, I think it's an issue of deep concern. There have been other instances of folks who have gone AWOL and have harmed fellow soldiers in the line of duty and off duty. I think that we can't use his case to indict Muslims across the board. I think the fact is that most people who have become radicalized in America are self-radicalized. They get on the internet, they go to these websites, they look at these videos from these so-called gatekeepers to the religion, and they reinforce and reaffirm growing anti-American sentiment that they already hold. And so I think he's one point, but critics of Islam have used him as an example and a reason why we shouldn't have Muslims in the military or Muslims in law enforcement. I think it's the wrong path to take.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm speaking with Representative Andre Carson. He's a Democrat from Indiana. He is one of two Muslim Americans currently serving in Congress. We're talking about the upcoming House Homeland Security Committee hearing to address the subject of the radicalization or the supposed radicalization of American Muslims. Those hearings are to be chaired by Congressman Peter King, a Republican of New York, later this week. But Representative Carson, I have to push you on the question of if there is this concern are hearings not an appropriate way to address it? Even if it's a misplaced concern,
sure.
What is the better approach, to pretend it doesn't exist or to air it and address it?
That's fine. I think Chairman King has a right to hold these hearings. But I'm more deeply concerned when Muslims, Representative Ellison will be allowed to testify, thank goodness, but Muslims, not just imams, Muslim attorneys, Muslim scholars, Muslim doctors, Muslim social scientists and scholars have not been allowed to testify at these hearings. And because of that, my suspicion is growing day by day. But let me just say this.
And you mentioned that you, even though you have a counterterrorism background, mm-hmm. an intelligence background, you presumably you've asked to testify and you have
yes,
not been
that is correct.
Offered an opportunity to testify. Do you know why?
No.
Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota, who was the first Muslim American to be sworn in to serve in Congress, will be allowed to testify.
He will be allowed to, and I know Keith will do a fantastic job.
I think it's fair to mention that Muslim Americans are not the only people who are expressing concern about these hearings.
That's right.
In a piece he penned for Politico, Representative Benny Thompson, he's the top Democrat on the Homeland Security Committee. He was the chair of that committee when
Brilliant
the Democrats
man.
Controlled the Congress. He wrote that, according to the Department of Homeland Security, lone wolves and small terrorist cells may be the single most dangerous threat we face. Attacks are just as likely to come from lone wolf extremists like James Von Brunn, the Holocaust Museum shooter, or Jared Lee Loeffner, who's charged with the tragedy in Tucson, Arizona, as they are from Muslim extremist groups. And Thompson goes on to add that the common denominator between many of these lone wolves is that they've articulated their positions on the internet. His argument is that the discussion needs to be around behavior.
Yes.
As opposed to identity and belonging to a particular group.
That reinforces my earlier point in the report compiled by the National Consortium on START. Islamic jihadists ranked number 11. And so I think we really need to look critically at really defining terrorism. It had the Ku Klux Klan, given the history in America, in fact a terrorist group. Other groups will meet the criteria as being terrorist groups. Terrorism in this country has an Islamic face, unfortunately. Are there Islamic bozos out there who really want to see harm done to Americans? Absolutely. We have to act and isolate the threat and deal with the threat effectively. However, there are other groups, particularly racial supremacist groups, who pose a greater threat to our internal security.
Well, finally, the hearings are going to go forward despite the fact that a number of people are very uncomfortable with them, including, you know, the White House. What will you be watching for as you see the hearings unfold? You will clearly be attending, even though
yes.
you have not been offered an opportunity to testify. What will you be looking for? And what do you recommend that the public look for as they evaluate these hearings going forward?
Unfortunately, these hearings won't be balanced. I think Benny Thompson makes a phenomenal point. He's a dear friend and a mentor. I will say this. I will be going across the country, as I've done. I was in New York yesterday at the I Am Muslim rally put on by Russell Simmons, Rabbi Schneier, and Imam Faisal, formerly of the now infamous Park 51 Mosque, if you will. And so people across the country are outraged. People across the country who love America are concerned. I told a story yesterday about Ben Franklin. During the Constitutional Convention. And after it was over, a lady by the name of Mrs. Powell walked up to Ben Franklin and she said, "Well, Ben, what do we have, a monarchy or a republic?" And Ben looked at Mrs. Powell and said, "We have a republic if you can keep it." How do we keep the republic? We keep the republic by being engaged. We keep the republic by speaking truth to power. We keep the republic by critiquing those who we have sent to Washington to represent our interests. We critique them and we call them on the carpet when we see them going astray. That's how we strengthen the republic, and that's how we keep the republic and being politically engaged.
Congressman Andre Carson represents Indiana's 7th District. He's one of two Muslim Americans currently serving in the U.S. Congress. He was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Congressman Carson, thank you so much for joining us.
Always an honor. Thank you.
Like many places in this country, the school system in the city of Memphis is mostly black, while the suburban system is mostly white. The two districts have had an uneasy relationship since Memphis schools were desegregated in the 1960s. For decades now, they have been battling over funding and school quality. Tomorrow, the people of Memphis will vote on a plan to merge the city's school system with the suburban one in Shelby County. As NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports, the proposal has reopened deep divisions over race and class.
On the face of it, tomorrow's vote is about the financial stability and quality of public schools in Shelby County and Memphis, which is part of Shelby County. But in reality,
it's been about money. It's been about power. It's not been about the kids. And that, to me, is the greatest tragedy of all.
David Pickler chairs Shelby County's Board of Education. It oversees 47,000 mostly white students, or about a third of the county's total student population. Memphis enrolls the other two-thirds, 103,000 students, almost all of whom are black. But unlike Memphis, says Pickler,
we are very blessed in Shelby County Schools. We have a tremendous legacy of strong family and parental support. We are trying to protect the children that we serve of all races, of all creeds, of all economic backgrounds, and we are trying to avoid being taken over by a school system that has a legacy of failure.
It was the fear of a hostile takeover by Memphis that convinced Pickler to ask the state legislature to make Shelby County a special school district with its own taxing authority. Members of the Memphis School Board say that would cut the city school funding almost in half. So they called for the merger to preempt Shelby County from separating. Shelby County school officials also oppose the merger because they say the two systems are so different. Their academic culture, their funding priorities are like night and day.
It's an unfortunate perception, but it is one that exists.
That's Deidre Malone, a former Shelby County commissioner and a longtime proponent of a merger. She says Pickler has tried to portray Memphis as a dysfunctional school system run by inept people. Malone admits Memphis has lots of struggling schools, but more than half are in good standing. So this is not about a terrible school system somehow infecting an excellent one.
And I'm going to tell you what I think the real fear is. The real fear is that the suburbanites lose control. The suburbanites will no longer be the majority in the district.
Shelby County's all-white seven-member school board would become part of a bigger board, most likely dominated by black Memphians. Now, trying to explain all of what you've heard thus far to voters, let alone making sense of the convoluted school funding formulas and tax schemes a merger would require, has been exhausting and tedious.
So if the referendum fails, as we responded, then they get a special school district status and...
Only 20 people showed up at this meeting at Douglas High School in one of the city's poorest neighborhoods. Afterwards, there were a few questions, but some people left confused. Carl Shaw was unsure of how he'll vote tomorrow.
Just trying to get a better understanding myself before we vote.
What is your biggest concern?
I guess my biggest concern is the effect on the kids.
Others left with a sense that it is all about race. Even though the merger does not call for busing black or white kids around, Laquita Boykin says Shelby County wants nothing to do with Memphis.
They merge, Memphis City school students will have more option to go to Shelby County schools. And that opens the gate, which they have held closed for so many years, they don't want to open.
Meanwhile, all that the pro and anti-merger campaigns have proven is that there is no consensus. Parent organizations, unions, teachers, the clergy are all split. And if you listen to local talk radio in Memphis, it reflects the divisions in the black community. Thaddeus Matthews on WPLX has leveled his harshest criticism at the minority of wealthy blacks who live in the county and also oppose a merger.
You bourgeois Negroes, now you're living in the suburbs and you want to think that you're better than everybody else. If your ass is out here telling black folk that our children do not deserve the same education as white children, y'all crazy as hell. Woo! It's 9:02 right here on AM 1180 WPLX.
As for tomorrow's vote, even if Memphis voters approve the merger, Shelby County school officials have vowed to do everything in their power to block it in the courts and continue to lobby the Tennessee legislature to protect their schools from ever having to merge with the Memphis City Schools. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
Next, we take a glimpse inside the pages of the Washington Post magazine, where we go just about every week for interesting stories about the way we live now. This week, the Post introduced us to a story out of West Virginia and a man named Jim Justice. He's got a hand in the agriculture, timber, and coal industries, not unusual for that part of the country. But now he is the sole owner of the iconic Greenbrier Resort, a famous playground for the well-to-do, once designated as a safe haven for Congress if the country was ever under attack. The Washington Post's Neely Tucker tells us more about Jim Justice's effort to restore the Greenbrier to glory. It's this week's cover story called The Richest Regular Guy. And Neely Tucker is with us now from the offices at The Post. Neely, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what I said restore to its former glory, but it wasn't really not glorious, but it was in significant financial trouble.
It was. The Greenbrier has been around for a really long time in its current incarnation, about a little more than a century. And if you go back close to, a little bit more than 200 years, what had happened was the hotel lost its fifth star in about 2000. And then had, because of the economy and some other factors, was really going downhill. It was in trouble. The place looked great, but financially, it was in a lot of trouble. By the mid-2000s or late 2000s, it was losing $1 million a week. That's a lot of money.
And well, explain, though, about why. I mean, a lot of people might be saying, well, so what about this fancy resort? I can't go there. What the heck do I care? But could you explain kind of why the Greenbrier is important, particularly in West Virginia?
Well, one, I think the it's the most iconic institution in West Virginia. Anybody in West Virginia knows the Greenbrier. It's Bell Star. It's its most famous place. And number two is a short thing. You can probably go there. They have off-season. They have rates around $150. They run packages. It's a point of Mr. Justice's that he wants people who live around there to be able to go there. But that said, the standard rack rate starts at about $300 a night. Meals there, it's pretty hard if you're not ordering pizza. It's pretty hard to get out of there for dinner for two for less than $100.
But it's a very luxurious environment, and then there's the history and so forth. How significant is it that here is a West Virginian who owns this property? And it has to be said that one of the things you point out in the story is that he actually beat out the Marriott hotel chain to gain the Greenbrier. Why does that matter?
It matters a lot to him on a point of a pride issue. He wants to show that people in West Virginia, which in his estimation has been the brunt of some pretty tough jokes, and I wouldn't tell him that he's wrong on that, that people in West Virginia can own and staff a hotel that is as luxurious as any place you'd come across in Paris or Hong Kong, that West Virginians just really know how to do this. Before, the hotel has been there for a really long time, but it's been run by the CSX Corporation. So in his mind, there was a little bit of an asterisk there that, yeah, it was in West Virginia, but it's being run by these folks from somewhere else. And now it's a purely West Virginia institution.
Well, one of the interesting things that you talk about him is the fact is he is tremendously wealthy. He would have to be to buy a luxury resort. But you met him at Applebee's, the chain. It was one of his favorite spots. He kind of likes to relax by coaching girls basketball, that he's actually pretty much of a he really is like a regular guy. You know, one of the tabloids has his feature called Normal or Not Normal, or, you know, and he's really, really, really normal. Does he really think that, I mean, can he bridge both those worlds is, I guess, the question. Be still the guy who likes to eat at Applebee's and run this 5-star resort that welcomes people from all over the world and is really, you know, a signature location.
What Jim is, I think, is as near as I can tell. I worked on the story off and on for about 6 months, and he is an astonishingly, almost frighteningly regular guy for somebody who has, you know, a couple of $1 billion at his disposal. As we put in the story, he bought his house where he still lives in Lewisburg for $205,000. It's not the nicest house on the block. He's the guy who owns 71 square miles of land and lives on 0.67 of an acre. There's not even a swimming pool. He and his wife don't go over to the Greenbrier and, you know, and hang out all the time. You mentioned the Applebee's incident. This was after a girls' basketball game where he's been coaching that for a number of years. And, you know, they could just drive over to the Greenbrier. It's 15 minutes, and he could go out on, you know, God, I guess, one of the penthouse suites there and order up room service, right? And instead, he drives down Route 219 and goes to Applebee's like everybody else after the game.
Well, so I guess you wish him the best. So, Neely, tell the truth. So did you plan a nice weekend getaway for you and the missus at the Greenbrier, saving your pennies for that?
Our wedding anniversary is coming up, and my wife has expressed to me that it sure would be nice to see this place that I got to go see.
Well, I won't. I'll keep it secret. So, Neely Tucker is a writer for the Washington Post magazine. He wrote this week's cover story, "The Richest Regular Guy." If you want to read the piece in its entirety, and we hope you will, we'll link to it on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on the programs page, and then on Tell Me More. Neely joined us from the studios at the Washington Post. Neely, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Doctors can face a similar challenge when trying to determine whether a woman has breast cancer. Research clearly shows that women with suspicious mammograms don't necessarily have to have surgery. Still, as NPR's Patty Naiman reports, doctors in different states are adapting to these findings at different rates.
If you live in Florida and have an abnormal mammogram which raises the possibility of cancer, you may find yourself in the OR, undergoing surgery to remove a lump of breast tissue. According to Dr. Stephen Grobmeier of the University of Florida, like all surgeries, there's a risk of complications.
That would include the potential for a wound infection, and of course there's always the issue of scarring, which occurs whenever you make an incision on the body.
And here's the irony. For most women, the surgery is unnecessary. The American College of Surgeons says most women, almost 90% of them, would do just as well with a diagnostic test called a needle biopsy. It's less invasive, less complicated, and according to lots of research, just as accurate as surgery. Radiologist Carol Lee sees patients at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York and performs needle biopsies.
We would give local anesthesia, similar to what the dentist uses. We make a tiny little nick in the skin. It's a quarter of an inch or less.
Then, guided by ultrasound, Lee inserts a needle into the breast and takes several tiny tissue samples, which are sent to a pathologist to determine if there's cancer. The procedure isn't terribly painful, but it's no walk in the park.
It felt like an elongated shot, so it wasn't great.
Heidi Waterfield is in her mid-40s. Over the years, she's had both surgical and needle biopsies because of lumps in her breasts. And for her, there's no question. The needle biopsy is preferable.
It is a little bit painful, but it's short, and there are no scars, and it's not invasive. And so once you're done, if they find that it's nothing to worry about, then you're done.
That's not the case with surgical biopsies. Waterfield had two of them more than 15 years ago when she was just in her 20s.
At that time, I was very conservative about such things and thought, just get it out. I was young and I was frightened.
Which is a common reaction among women when the doctor tells them they're concerned about cancer. In Heidi Waterfield's case, all her biopsies were benign, and she never really needed surgery. She's not alone. Dr. Grobmeier just completed a study in Florida.
Approximately 30% of biopsies are being done using an open surgical technique. This is 3 to 5 times higher than is the national recommendation.
And it's not just Florida. Surgical biopsy rates are also higher than recommended in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania.
We think it may primarily be an educational issue. The needle biopsy has been accepted for only the last 10 to 15 years.
But nationwide, the tides are shifting, says Dr. David P. Winchester with the American College of Surgeons. He's just finished a study that shows doctors in most states are using needle biopsies. And he expects the slower states will catch up over the next few years, propelled in large part by the patients themselves.
Women in this country are pretty savvy about how to get information online. And they now come into doctor's offices well-armed with information about how to approach not only diagnosis, but treatment.
There are some cases where a needle biopsy is not feasible, but if your doctor doesn't suggest it, then radiologist Lee says you need to bring it up.
If a woman is not given the option of a needle biopsy, I certainly think she should ask, why not?
Because the vast majority of women who have biopsies don't have cancer. Patty Naiman, NPR News.